There are places where the night feels heavier than it should, where a streetlight flickers over an empty sidewalk, and the silence seems to hold its breath. Most people never notice those moments. They walk past them. They drive past them. They live entire lives without ever stopping to feel the weight of what ordinary moments actually cost. Because ordinary feels safe. Ordinary feels predictable. Ordinary is the story we tell ourselves so we can keep moving through the world without fear. But the ordinariness is a lie we agree to believe together. And we need that agreement. We need it the way we need other comfortable fictions. The belief that the neighborhood we live in is a good neighborhood. That the people around us are mostly decent. That the worst things happen somewhere else, to someone else, in circumstances that will never reach us. That agreement is not dishonesty. It is a necessary way of moving through the world. Without it, the weight of what is possible would make ordinary life impossible. But sometimes, without warning, without ceremony, without a single sign that anything is about to change, the ordinary world tears open and something crawls through. La Crosse, Wisconsin, July 29th, 2005. A 15-year-old girl leaves a laundromat with nothing but the short walk home ahead of her. She tells her mother she's heading back. Her mother nods. The machines keep spinning. The dryers keep humming. And the girl steps outside into a warm summer evening and starts walking. One block, maybe two. Streetlights glowing soft and orange above her. Houses with porch lights on. The smell of cut grass and warm concrete drifting through the air. A normal summer night in the Midwest. A night that should have ended with the front door opening. Shoes dropped by the stairs. The television on somewhere in the background. The ordinary machinery of a life continuing forward without incident. But Madeline Edmond never makes it home. No witnesses step forward. No clear evidence surfaces. No sound carries back through the summer air to say what happened. Only silence. And in the years that follow, a family's grief, a community's confusion, and a question that has never stopped echoing in the streets of La Crosse. Because when someone disappears in the middle of an ordinary moment, it means something was already waiting for them in the dark. And whatever that something was, it has never been identified. It has never been stopped. It has never answered for what it did. Welcome to Among Monsters. I'm Maya Vale. This is the podcast where we step into the darkest corners of real human stories. Cases where people vanish without explanation. Cases where predators hide in plain sight for years. Sometimes for decades. Because where the truth sits buried beneath layers of silence, assumption, and the passage of time, waiting for someone to finally refuse to look away. I started this show because I believe that the stories we stop telling are the stories that stay unsolved. And tonight's story is one that has been quietly fading for nearly 20 years. It isn't about a notorious serial killer whose face appeared on magazine covers. It isn't about a famous crime scene that investigators still reference in training manuals. It's about something quieter than that. Something far more unsettling. A disappearance that happened in plain sight, in the middle of a normal summer evening, on a street of a city where people believed they were safe. This is the story of Madeline Edmond. A 15-year-old girl who walked away from an ordinary errand and was never seen again. To understand what happened to Madeline Edmond, you first have to understand where it happened. La Crosse, Wisconsin sits along the eastern bank of the Mississippi River in the western part of the state. It's the kind of city that doesn't always make national headlines. It isn't known for its crime. It isn't known for its danger. It's known for its river views. Its college bars, its hiking trails, up into the bluffs that rise steeply on the eastern edge of town. Roughly 50,000 people call it home. Freight trains cut through the middle of downtown, their horns carrying across the water on quiet evenings. The University of Wisconsin La Crosse and Viterbo University anchor large student populations that cycle through each year. Young people everywhere, coffee shops, bike paths, the kind of comfortable mid-sized city where transplants move and say, it just feels like home. And in summer, La Crosse is genuinely beautiful. The Mississippi turns silver in the late afternoon light. Families pack the riverfront parks on weekends. Kids jump off rope swings into the backwater sloughs. Cicadas fill the trees with their relentless, heavy sound. The bluffs glow green and gold above the rooftops. In that context, in that atmosphere, the idea that something terrible could happen feels almost impossible to hold on to, because the city itself resists the idea. It insists on its own safety, its own normalcy, its own warm and uneventful summer evenings. In that instance, that agreement that bad things don't happen here is precisely what makes the story of Madeline Edmonds so difficult to accept, because it happened here, in the middle of all the warmth and normalcy and soft summer light, on a street where anyone might have been watching from a window or sitting on a porch or pulling into a driveway. It happened anyway, and no one saw it coming. Madeline Kelly Edmond was 15 years old in the summer of 2005. She was young in the way that 15 carries its own particular kind of weight. Old enough to feel independent, old enough to want to test the independence, but still just a kid in every way that matters. Still figuring out what music said something true about the world. Still figuring out which friendships were real. Still carrying all the sharp, unfinished edges of adolescence. People who knew Madeline remember a typical teenager, curious, energetic in the way that young people are before the world teaches them to slow down. Trying like every 15-year-old to understand where she belonged. Physically, she was slight. About 5'4" tall, roughly 100 pounds, brown hair. She would have been easy to overlook in a crowd. The kind of person who might pass you on the sidewalk without drawing much attention, except for her eyes. Because if you looked at Madeline's face, you would notice immediately. She had heterochromia, a rare condition in which each eye is a different color. Her right eye was a clear, bright blue. Her left eye was a deep, rich brown. It is the kind of physical detail that makes someone genuinely unmistakable. The kind of feature that people don't forget. If you had ever spoken to Madeline, even for 30 seconds, you would remember her eyes. They are, even now, the most powerful identifying feature investigators have. Madeline also had several tattoos, a small cross on her arm, a heart on her hip, the letters TC on her ankle, each one a small declaration of identity. Little marks etched into the skin of someone who was still becoming who she would be. Someone who was still in the middle of the project of figuring out her own story. There is one more detail that investigators would come to consider important. Madeline sometimes used the last name Acevedo rather than Edmond. That detail, a variation in identity, a second name would matter later. Because when someone disappears, names become critical. The wrong name attached to the right person can mean the difference between a case that stays open and a case that closes far too soon. July 29th, 2005 began the way that most summer days began in a Midwestern city. Warm, slow. The warm settling into the afternoon rhythm before the heat finally gave way to evening. Nothing about that day singled anything out of the ordinary. No argument that we know of. No conflict. No moment of tension that might explain what came later. Just a mother and her teenage daughter handling one of the most mundane tasks in domestic life, the laundry. The laundromat they visited was located near the intersection of St. James Street and Caledonia Street on La Crosse's south side. If you've ever spent an evening in a laundromat, you know what the atmosphere is like. It has its own particular quality of waiting. Rows of industrial washing machines churning in steady cycles. Dryers tumbling loudly behind round glass windows. The warm, faintly chemical smell of detergent mixing with hot air. Plastic chairs lined up against the walls. A couple of folding tables running down the center of the room. Maybe a small television mounted on one corner playing something no one is really watching. People pass time in laundromats. They read. They scroll through their phones. They stare at the machines as though the rhythm of the spinning drum might contain some answer to something. It is in almost every sense a place designed to be forgotten. Nobody goes to the laundromat expecting anything to happen. Nobody goes to the laundromat and thinks, "This is a moment I will spend the rest of my life trying to reconstruct." At some point during that evening, Madeline decided to walk home. Her mother was staying behind to finish the laundry. There was nothing alarming about this. Teenagers make this kind of call constantly. "I'm bored. I'm heading back. See you there." The walk was not a long one. By almost any measure, it was a short trip through a residential neighborhood. A few blocks, a few minutes. The kind of walk a 15-year-old can do on autopilot, thinking about other things entirely. And so Madeline's mother said something close to yes or fine or okay. And Madeline walked out the door and the laundromat kept humming behind her. And the evening stretched out ahead of her, warm and quiet and entirely ordinary. And that was the last time that anyone has ever confirmed seeing her. Picture the scene the way investigators were forced to reconstruct it. You have to build it from almost nothing, just the starting point. The laundromat door, and the endpoint, a home that was never reached. Everything in between is inference. It was a July evening in Wisconsin. The air was warm and still carrying the heat of the day. The sun would have been low by then, dropping toward the bluffs, painting the undersides of the clouds in soft orange and pink. The streetlights would have been beginning to glow, not fully dark, not fully light. That particular hour that sits between the two, the edge of evening, when visibility is imperfect and people's attention is drifting inward towards dinner and the end of the day and the particular private gravity of their own lives. No one is watching the street with purpose. No one is cataloging who walks past. Everyone is simply existing inside their own world, behind their own windows, inside their own evenings. And that collective inwardness, that perfectly ordinary failure of attention, is a condition that the worst kind of people have always known how to exploit. Madeline would have stepped off the curb from the laundromat and turned towards home. Maybe she knew the route well. Maybe she walked it a dozen times. Maybe she wasn't thinking about the route at all, just putting one foot in front of the other, one block, then another. Passing houses where porch lights were just beginning to come on. Passing parked cars sitting still in driveways. Maybe a neighbor watering a garden in the last of the evening light. Maybe someone carrying groceries up to their front steps, fumbling for keys. Ordinary life, busy with its own concerns, entirely absorbed in itself. She might have been listening to something in her head. A song, a conversation she'd been replaying, plans for the next day. She might have been thinking about nothing at all. That is the particular quality of a familiar walk. It becomes automatic. The body handles the route while the mind travels somewhere else entirely. And when the body is on autopilot, when attention is elsewhere, that is when the windows open for someone waiting to take advantage. Somewhere along that route. Somewhere in the narrow corridor between where she started and where she was supposed to arrive, something interrupted her. Something ended the walk. When Madeline's mother returned home from the laundromat, Madeline wasn't there. The absence was the first sign. The house without Madeline in it. the question forming slowly, then faster. Where is she? She left before I did. Where is she? She should already be home. Where is she? The escalation from mild curiosity to low-level worry to genuine alarm is something every parent of a missing child has described. The moment that ordinary explanation runs out. The moment where you've checked every room, called every name, and the silence answers back. The moment you pick up the phone with a feeling in your chest that you have never felt before and hope to God you'll never feel it again. In missing person cases, investigators will sometimes refer to the concept of the vanishing point. The moment or location where a person transitions from visible to gone. For Madeline, that point exists somewhere between the laundromat on St. James Street and the place she should have been safe. No one has ever been able to name it precisely. No security camera captured the transition. No waitress stepped forward to say, "I saw her on this corner at this time, going in this direction." The vanishing point remains unknown. And that absence of information, that gap in the record, is one of the most haunting aspects of this case. Because a 15-year-old girl disappeared in a populated residential neighborhood on a warm summer evening, and the world around her apparently failed to notice. The street kept its secrets and has never given them back. When someone goes missing, there is a pattern to how investigations begin. Investigators start with the same set of questions every time because experience has taught them that the answers to these questions are almost always found in the first hours. Who was the last person to see her? Where exactly was that? What time? What was she wearing? Where was she heading? Was there anyone she might have met along the way? Was there anyone she was afraid of? Was there anyone she had recently connected with online or in person that her family didn't know about? These questions are the foundation. They generate leads. They generate timelines. They generate the shape of what might have happened. But in cases involving teenage girls, there is always one question that arrives early and carries enormous consequences. Is it possible she ran away? That question is not asked out of cruelty. It is asked because it is statistically necessary. Every year, hundreds of thousands of teenagers are reported missing in the United States. And a significant portion of them are not missing in the way that the word implies. They are teenagers who made a choice to leave, to escape something, to find something better somewhere else, to put distance between themselves and a situation that felt unbearable. Running away is often an act of survival. It is often the rational response of circumstances the rest of the world hasn't fully seen. And so investigators must consider it. They must ask whether a missing teenager left by choice before they can fully commit to the possibility that they didn't. But the runaway designation, when applied too quickly, without significant evidence, can be catastrophically damaging to an investigation. It lowers the urgency of the search. It changes the resources allocated. It shifts the tone of every interview. And perhaps most crucially, it changes the public's perception of the case. A missing teenager who might have run away does not generate the same alarm as a teenager who is believed to have been taken. That distinction, that single word, runaway, dropped into a news brief, can be the difference between a community mobilizing immediately and a community waiting to see what develops. And that waiting, that hesitation, can give the person responsible exactly the time they need. In the early stages of Madeline's case, the question of a possible runaway was part of the conversation. It had to be. Standard procedure demanded it, but there was a serious consequential problem with that theory. Runaways leave trails. They tell someone, a friend, a boyfriend, a classmate they trusted with the plan. They make a call once they've arrived somewhere. They send a message to say they're okay, even if they don't say where they are. They reach out eventually. Because running away from home, especially at 15, still requires a network of support. It still requires someone to trust. None of that materialized in Madeline's case. No friend came forward with a plan she had confided. No phone call surfaced. No sighting was confirmed from outside La Crosse. No one said, "I knew she was leaving." Nothing. Just a girl who walked away from a laundromat and stopped existing, as far as the record was concerned. The absence was not the absence of a teenager who had made a plan and followed through with it. It was the absence of something else entirely. Something that investigators were going to have to take seriously, even if it was difficult, even if the answers weren't there yet, even if the timeline was already moving against them. When investigators work a disappearance like this one, the neighborhood itself becomes a document. They walk the route. They knock on doors. They ask people who live along the path between the last sighting and the intended destination. "Did you see a young girl around this time, on this street, brown hair, about this tall, mismatched eyes, one blue, one brown?" Most of the time, people try to help. They reach back into their memory. They replay the evening. They look for the moment a girl walked past their window. And in most cases, someone remembers something, a glimpse, a detail, a small thread that investigators can pull. But what emerged from canvassing the neighborhood around Madeline's intended route told a deeply troubling story. Nobody remembered seeing her. The timeline held no confirmed witness who could place Madeline anywhere between the laundromat door and the home she never reached. That silence, that gap in the collective memory of a neighborhood, can mean several things. It can mean the walk was so unremarkable that no one was paying attention. It can mean that what happened, happened very fast. It can mean that whatever disrupted Madeline's walk occurred in a location without line of sight to any occupied window or yard. Or it can mean that a vehicle was involved, and that the disappearance was measured not in city blocks, but in seconds. Cases, the forensic understanding of stranger abductions. Cases where a victim is taken quickly and without an established prior relationship is built largely around the concept of the opportunity window. That is the narrow window of time in which a predator identifies a target, makes a decision, and acts. Research drawn from investigative case files and survivor testimony suggests that many abductions happen in under 30 seconds from an initial contact. In those cases, the mechanics are grimly simple. A vehicle slows, a window comes down, words are exchanged or not, and within moments, a door opens, a grip is established, and a person is gone. For anyone standing 100 yards away, or watching from a second floor window, the scene might look almost normal. A teenager getting into a car. Someone they recognize. Someone they were waiting for. The brain fills in the story it expects. Everything looks fine. And by the time the brain catches up to the reality of what actually happened, the vehicle is out of sight. The street is empty. And a girl is already somewhere she didn't choose to be. This is the scenario investigators would have considered seriously in Madeline's case. A warm summer evening, reduced foot traffic in a residential neighborhood, a young girl walking alone on a predictable route, someone familiar with that route, or someone who simply happened to be driving past at precisely the wrong moment. The intersection of those two things, a girl alone and someone willing to do something monstrous, is where cases like Madeline's begin. Not in elaborate planning, not in elaborate staging, but in a single terrible moment of opportunity that the victim never saw coming. There is a detail in the case that carries particular weight, not because it changes the trajectory of the investigation, but because it tells you something about the cost of unresolved disappearances, about who pays the cost, about how long they pay it. Madeline's mother spent years waiting for word of her daughter. That is not a metaphor. That is a literal description of how many families of the missing pass their lives, waiting for the phone to ring, waiting for an alert to appear, waiting for a detective to appear at the door with news that is either devastating or redemptive, but at least a kind of answer. And because no answers came, Madeline's mother waited without resolution. She waited through summers and winters and all the ordinary days in between. She waited through the years. And in 2010, 5 years after her daughter walked away from the laundromat, Madeline's mother passed away. What matters? What should have been said clearly and without qualification is that in her obituary, Madeline was still listed among the surviving children. She was still counted. She was still claimed. Even in grief, even in death, a mother refused to surrender her daughter to the void of the unexplained. That act of refusal, of insisting that Madeline's existence, even in the absence of any evidence of her fate, is one of the most quietly devastating things about this case. Because it tells you what living with a missing person looks like. Not the dramatic version you see in films. Not the obsessive wall of clues and frantic searching. Just the quiet, daily act of holding on. Of keeping the name alive in the space where answers should be. Of going to your own grave with your child's name still on your lips and the question still unanswered. Missing person cases do not have natural endings. They do not close the way that solved cases close, with a courtroom and a verdict and the specific weight of a sentence pronounced. They remain open, in theory, always open. But the particular reality of cold case investigations is that resources shift. Investigators rotate onto new cases. Tips slow to a trickle and then to nothing. The file sits in a drawer or a database, waiting for the specific combination of new information and dedicated attention that might finally move it forward. The world keeps moving, and the case moves with it, quietly, invisibly, carried forward in the small ways that missing person cases are kept alive. Online communities dedicated to the unresolved. Families who refuse to stop. And increasingly, in the modern era, podcasts. Shows exactly like this one, where a name that has begun to fade is spoken aloud again. Where an audience of thousands hears a story that most of them have never heard before. Where someone somewhere, sitting in a car on a commute or folding laundry on Tuesday afternoon, hears a name and feels something shift inside their memory. The National Missing and Unidentified Persons System maintains a public registry of cases exactly like Madeline's. Madeline Edmond is in that system. Her entry carries the identifying marks that make her unmistakable. The heterochromia, one blue eye, one brown eye. The tattoos, the cross, the heart, the initials on her ankle, the second name that she sometimes used. These details are not there for sediment. They are there because physical identifiers are the mechanism through which unidentified remains, missing persons are matched. Because a Jane Doe found in one state and a missing person report filed in another can sit in separate databases for years without connecting. Until a dedicated examiner runs the comparison. Until a family submits a DNA sample. Until forensic artists reconstruct a face from something that was once unidentifiable. Until the technology catches up to what the case always needed. These tools exist today in forms that didn't exist in 2005. It has closed cases that have been cold for 40 years. DNA phototyping can generate physical descriptions, eye color, hair color, ancestry from a biological sample alone. Facial reconstruction technology has advanced beyond anything investigators had access to in the mid-2000s. Each of these tools is a door that was not open in 2005, and each of them is open now. The investigation into Madeline's disappearance may benefit from technology that simply did not exist when she vanished. That is not a small thing. That is a reason for cautious, sustained hope. Cold cases do resolve. Sometimes years after the disappearance, sometimes decades, sometimes through a database match, made in the quiet middle of the night by a computer running comparisons that would take a human analysis a lifetime to complete manually, sometimes through a memory surfacing in someone who had long ago convinced themselves that what they witnessed meant nothing. The machinery of resolution is slow and imperfect, but it keeps turning, and Madeline's case is still inside it. At this point in the story, it is important to be honest about what we know and what we don't, because speculation in a missing person case is both inevitable and dangerous. Inevitable because the absence of answers creates a gravitational pull toward theory. Our minds want explanations. They work toward them, even when the evidence is insufficient. And dangerous because unfounded theories can obscure the truth. They can point attention in the wrong direction. They can provide comfort that makes people less willing to keep asking hard questions. So here is what we know. Madeline Edmond left a laundromat in La Crosse, Wisconsin on the evening of July 29, 2005. She was 15 years old. She was walking home. She never arrived. No credible witness placed her beyond the point of departure. No confirmed contact with family or friends followed her disappearance. Her mother continued to believe she was alive through the 5 years she had left to hope. No definitive answer as to what happened to Madeline has ever been made public. Here is what we do not know. Whether someone was waiting for her, whether someone took her by force, whether she encountered someone she trusted and that trust was weaponized against her, whether she chose to leave and encountered something dangerous after leaving, whether she is alive somewhere in the world right now, whether she is not. Each of these possibilities is still technically open. And what that means, in the plainest possible terms, is that this case is unsolved. Not cold in the sense of dead. Cold in the sense of waiting. Among Monsters. That's the name of this show. And every episode, I find myself returning to the same question. Not who the monster was, but how the monster moves. Because the monsters in these stories are not the ones from fiction. They don't announce themselves. They don't carry visible marks of what they are. They are not strange. They are not wild-eyed. They are not visibly broken in ways that would allow the people around them to see the danger. They are ordinary, disturbingly, completely ordinary. They live in cities like La Crosse. They drive ordinary cars through ordinary neighborhoods. They stand in lines at grocery stores and nod to their neighbors and wave when the school bus goes by. They hold jobs. Some of them hold jobs that put them in contact with vulnerable people. Some of them have families of their own. Some of them, by every external measure, are simply people. And that ordinariness is not an accident. It is a tool. The most dangerous predators in these stories are the ones who have learned to weaponize the assumptions of ordinary people. They understand that most of us are not watching for them, that most of us default to trust, that a person who seems normal triggers no alarms, no hesitation, no instinct to be cautious. And they use that understanding the way a key uses a lock, quietly, precisely, without announcing what it is doing until the door has already opened. The person who encountered Madeline Edmond, if an encounter is what happened, knew something. They knew that the residential street at dusk is quieter than it looks. They knew that a teenage girl walking alone is a specific kind of vulnerability. They knew that 30 seconds is enough time. They knew how to be invisible. And in the years since that July evening, they have continued to be invisible. They have continued to exist somewhere in the world, continuing to be a neighbor, a coworker, a person in line at the laundromat, carrying the knowledge of what they did, carrying it through years, through the death of Madeline's mother, through the slow fade of public attention, through every summer evening in La Crosse that looked exactly like the evening everything changed. That is the nature of the monster in these stories. Not monstrous in appearance, monstrous in what they know and refuse to say. and monstrous in the belief, the quiet, sustaining belief that no one will ever make them say it. That is the belief this show exists to challenge every single time. 20 years is a long time. It is long enough for communities to reshape themselves, long enough for buildings to come down and new ones to go up, long enough for people who were teenagers in 2005 to now have teenagers of their own, long enough for details to blur and memories to soften, and the specific texture of a particular summer evening to fade into the general past. But some details don't fade. Some details are encoded deeply enough that they survive the passage of decades. And in Madeline's case, those details are the same ones that have always been there. Her eyes. One blue, one brown. If Madeline is alive today, and no evidence has definitively confirmed otherwise, she would be approximately 35 years old. She would be a woman in her mid-30s, and she would still have mismatched eyes. That physical fact does not change. It does not age into something unrecognizable. If she encountered a doctor, a social worker, a law enforcement officer, a shelter worker, a nurse, anyone at any point in the last 20 years, her eyes would have been notable. The cross tattoo on her arm, the heart on her hip, the initials TC on her ankle, the name that she sometimes used. These are not abstractions. These are the specific physical permanent markers of an individual human being. They are the reason missing person database exists. They are the reason this case stays open. And they are the reason this story must continue to be told. Because someone somewhere may have seen those eyes. They may not have known what they meant, but the memory is there, and memory can be unlocked. Sometimes all it takes is hearing a name. I want to speak directly to you for a moment, not as a host, not in the cinematic register of this show, just as someone who believes that stories like Madeline's deserve to be heard by as many people as possible. There is a painful irony in missing person cases. The ones that receive the most sustained public attention are often the ones that generated the most media coverage in the early days. The cases with press conferences and national news segments and search parties that stretched across county lines. Those cases stay in the public consciousness because they are planted there with urgency and amplified through repetition. But the cases that slip through, the ones involving young people from less visible communities, the ones where the initial assumption of a runaway slowed this critical early response, the one that didn't have the resources, momentum of national attention behind them. But the cases that slipped through, the ones involving young people with less visible communities, the ones where the initial assumption of a runaway slowed the critical early response, the one that didn't have the resources or the momentum of national attention behind them. Those cases fade. The names grow quieter. The coverage thins. Busy with its own relentless forward motion, begins to move past them. And when a case fades, something genuinely dangerous happens. The perpetrator's confidence grows. The witnesses who weren't sure whether to come forward decided it's too late now. That too much time has passed. That no one is listening anymore anyway. The people who saw something they weren't even sure was relevant, talked themselves out of making the call. The silence compounds, layer on layer, year on year. Until 20 years have passed, and a 15-year-old girl from La Crosse, Wisconsin is a name that only her surviving family and a handful of database entries carry forward. Telling this story is a small act of resistance against that silence. It is a refusal to let Madeline Edmond become a name that only people who loved her remember. It is a way of keeping the question alive in the world where the answer might still be found. Because answers do come. They come in unexpected ways and from unexpected directions. A DNA match generated from a database submission made decades after the disappearance. A tip called into a non-emergency line by someone who heard a name on a podcast during their morning commute and suddenly remembered something they'd buried. A person who finally, after years of carrying a weight they never should have had to carry, decades, to set it down. It happens. It happens in cases that have been cold for far longer than this one. There is a woman named Lori Erica Ruff, whose true identity remained unknown for over a decade after her death. A Jane Doe found in Texas in 1980 wasn't identified for 33 years. Solved through a DNA sample and a family tree built by a forensic genealogist sitting at a computer decades after the body was found. Cold is not the same as closed. Dark is not the same as gone. And silence is not the same as an answer. Someone listening to this right now may know something about Madeline Edmond. Not something dramatic, not a confession, just a detail. A moment from the summer of 2005 that has sat quietly in the back of your mind without ever fully connecting to a name. A vehicle you saw on a particular street at a particular time. A conversation you overheard. A person whose behavior seemed slightly wrong, slightly off, and in a way you couldn't quite articulate. Those fragments matter. Those small, uncertain memories matter enormously to investigators working missing person cases. Because cases are built from fragments, from small pieces that individually look like nothing, but together begin to form a picture. Call the La Crosse Police Department. Call the National Center of Missing and Exploited Children. You don't have to be certain. You don't have to have a complete story. You just have to make the call. Madeline Edmond was 15 years old. She was a girl with mismatched eyes and a small cross tattooed on her arm, and the whole complicated, unfinished project of her life still in front of her. She was still in the middle of becoming whoever she was going to be, still carrying all the questions that 15 carries, still holding possibilities that no one had any right to take from her. She left a laundromat in La Crosse, Wisconsin, on a warm summer evening in July of 2005. She walked towards home, and somewhere between the door she walked out of and the door she was walking toward, she vanished. No confirmed witness, no clear physical evidence made public, no explanation that closes the loop. Just a quiet neighborhood on the south side of a river city, carrying a mystery that has refused to fade for nearly 20 years. Her mother waited for her for 5 years. She waited without answers. She waited without resolution, and she died still counting her daughter among the living. That is the cost of an unsolved disappearance. Not just the absence of the missing person, but the way the absence reshapes every life it touches. The years lived in suspension, the hope that never fully goes out, because there is nothing definitive enough to extinguish it. The love that keeps a name written in an obituary long after the world has moved on. Madeline deserves better than that. Her family deserves better than that. And the truth, whatever it is, has been waiting long enough. But here is what I believe. I believe someone knows something. I believe there is a person in the world right now who has a memory, a detail, a moment, a face, a vehicle, a conversation that belongs to this case. Maybe they don't know it belongs to this case. Maybe they've told themselves it was nothing. Maybe they've spent 20 years convincing themselves that the thing they saw didn't mean what they thought it meant, but they know. And if there's any chance at all that telling this story reaches that person, if there is any chance that hearing Madeline's name tonight unlocks something that has been sitting quietly in the back of someone's memory for 2 decades, then it is worth every word. Because monsters survive on darkness. They survive on silence. They survive on the world's willingness to look away and move on and tell itself that some questions will never be answered. But the truth is patient in a way that monsters are not. The truth has an almost infinite capacity to wait for the moment when the light finally finds it. And every time Madeline's name is spoken, the darkness gets a little smaller, If you have any information about the disappearance of Madeline Edmond, please contact the La Crosse Police Department or your local law enforcement agency. If you believe you may have seen Madeline or have information about her current whereabouts, contact the National Center of Missing and Exploited Children. Even the smallest detail matters. Even the thing you've talked yourself out of 100 times. Make the call. I'm Maya Vale. This is Among Monsters. Stay aware. Stay curious. Stay present in the world around you. Because the most important thing any of us can do for the missing is refuse to forget.